and the legitimate government of Yemen, led by Popular Ansarullah Movement, are eager for extending the two-month ceasefire worked out on the eve of fasting Ramadan with aggressor Saudi Arabia, despite the latter's frequent violation of the same. The United States is busy trying to fish in troubled waters. Ever the enemy of the world people, especially of Muslims, and in particular the masses resisting regional tyrants and foreign hegemons, Washington, which supplies Riyadh with deadly weapons, is trying to set up military bases in southern and eastern parts of Yemen. Of course, the awakened people of Yemen will definitely confront the Yankees as well as the betrayers of the Palestinian cause, who treason first destabilized Syria and Iraq and has now heaped death and destruction on the Arab world's most impoverished country. Inspired by the indomitable spirit of such Islamic nationalist leaders as Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, the various tribes and political groups of Yemen are determined to thwart the devilish designs of the pro-US Zionist forces. The parliament in Sana'a is now all set to debate and pass a law criminalizing any form of relationship with usurper Israel. Following the recent enactment of the Iraqi parliament to imprison or even sentence to death any traitor advocating ties with the illegal Zionist entity or having any sort of dealings with Tel Aviv. This means, in Yemen, the misconstrued idea of setting up diplomatic ties with the occupiers of Islam's former Qibla, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, whose sanctity is almost daily being desecrated by bands of armed Zionists, never arises. The various tribes and political parties of Yemen understand this and are angry at the UAE occupation forces for facilitating the infiltration of Israelis in several Yemeni islands, especially the ecological wonderland of Socotra, where the Zionists have been allowed to set up a base. In his recent meeting in Sana'a with a delegation of tribal leaders and dignitaries from the southwestern Yemeni province of Ep, the Ansarullah leader dwelt on the devilish designs of the U.S. and the Zionist regime through their agents, the Saudis and the Emiratis. Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi made it clear, neither can we accept to be ruled by U.S. dictates, nor can recognize traitors and agents who would prefer to be manipulated by Saudi or Emirati officers. He said, the main objective of enemies is to eradicate all elements of national unity, coherence and strength in Yemen in order to exert their dominance over the country, reiterating, the Yemeni nation is firmly determined to tread the path towards independence and freedom and block foreign interference. It is to be noted that the Americans, with the help of the Saudis and their local agents, the Takfiri terrorists, are building several military bases in the country's eastern provinces of Hadhramaut and Al-Mahra, as well as on the Red Sea coast. Riyadh intends to annex these two sparsely populated but mineral-rich strategic regions and would most likely hand them over to the Israelis. This was the reason Saudi Arabia has recently set up a council of six Yemenis who are loyal to the Wahhabis and the Americans and placed them in charge of governing southern Yemen. In the words of Sayyid al-Houthi, they brought a bunch of criminals, traitors and thieves to power and declared them as the leaders of the Yemeni nation in order to set up ties with the Zionist entity. They are actually the picks of outsiders, not of Yemenis. He vowed to continue resistance against the Saudis, the Emiratis, and the U.S. by saying, The parties displaying animosity and military aggression against our nation are the ones that are pushing for the normalization of ties with the Israeli enemy, but will never succeed.
On fire. Part 2.
Here in Kiev in recent days, the Maidan Independent Square has turned into a full-scale war zone.
More clashes in Ukraine's capital, Kiev.
There is absolutely no doubt that snipers are working here. I've counted 10 bodies.
Now on the brink of a civil war, at least 70 dead so far, and the death toll rising.
What we saw here today was a revolution.
We've invested over $5 billion to assist Ukraine in these and other goals.
NATO has expanded into 13 countries, up to the borders of Russia. 13 countries.
The focus has to be on not allowing this crisis to turn into hot war between Ukraine and Russia.
Ukraine. It's an ancient and proud land with a rich history filled with much beauty, heroism, and sacrifice. Ukraine is a borderland, a place where east meets west. This is the flag of Ukraine. The blue represents the sky, the gold its seemingly endless fields of wheat. Ukraine is a prize many have sought, and much blood has spilled in the quest to possess it. Ukraine has been the pathway for Western powers as they attempted to conquer the East. Another historical document that changed the fate of Ukraine was the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939, one of many such agreements being signed between European countries and rising Germany. Attempting to protect his nation from the approaching Nazi threat, Joseph Stalin negotiated a treaty of non-aggression with Adolf Hitler. While promising each other peace, the Soviet and German foreign ministers Molotov and Ribbentrop realigned the map of Eastern Europe, splitting it into German and Soviet spheres of influence. In January 1943, USSR troops started pushing the Nazis back, liberating one part of Ukraine after another. Western Ukraine was the last Ukrainian region held by the Germans, finally being liberated in October of 1944. The era of political and military tension between the US and the USSR lasted for nearly 45 years, keeping humanity under the constant threat of nuclear war. In this battle, the United States never lost sight of Ukraine's importance. U.S. intelligence kept a close eye on Ukrainian nationalist organizations as a possible source of counterintelligence against the Soviet Union. CIA documents that just recently have been declassified show strong ties between U.S. intelligence and Ukrainian nationalists since 1946. From the CIA agency report, it is clear that they were not mistaken about the nature of Ukrainian nationalist organizations or their leader, Stepan Bandera, himself. By 1954, the agency excused the illegal activities of the OUN security branch in the name of Cold War necessity. In 1949, Mykola Lebed, the man responsible for the massacres in Volhynia, was moved to the United States, where he died in 1989 without ever being investigated or pursued as a war criminal. the CIA moved to protect Ukrainian nationalist leader Mykola Lebed from criminal investigation by the Immigration and Naturalization Service in 1952. The Cold War would heat up and cool down by turns, while both rivals were obsessively building up military capacity. The turning point took place when the new era, Perestroika, came to the USSR with its new leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, in the middle of the 1980s. Perestroika meant restructuring towards liberalization and democratization. It certainly had a positive impact on the international situation.
Astonishing news from East Germany, where the East German authorities have said, in essence, that the Berlin Wall doesn't mean anything anymore.
But inside the USSR, the weakening of Kremlin control had different consequences. The people's growing discontent made Ukraine more vulnerable to outside forces, and a new kind of warfare was launched, one not known before, the color revolutions.
Violent clashes erupted in the Ukrainian capital Kiev as more than 100,000 people protested against a government decision to delay an association deal with the EU.
Arseniy Yatsenyuk, leader of the opposition party, Fatherland. Oleg Tagnibok, leader of the opposition nationalist far-right political party, Svoboda. Vitaly Klitschko, leader of the opposition party, UDAR.
Both EU and Ukrainian officials said on Thursday the suspension of talks on closer ties could be revived after the two-day meeting. But officials said the deal was off the table for now.
Pro-EU protests on the streets of Kiev enter their second day. The crowd of around 1,000 protesters were joined by the leader of the opposition, the reigning world boxing champion Vitaly Klitschko. He called on the demonstrators to maintain pressure on the government after it decided not to sign a major trade deal with the EU.
Robert Perry is a longtime investigative journalist based in Washington, D.C., best known for his major disclosures about the Iran-Contra scandal in the 1980s. He is the founder of Consortium News, where he has reported extensively on the crisis in Ukraine and the forces behind the unrest.
An NGO is a non-governmental organization. Now, many NGOs are quite legitimate. They represent good causes. Maybe they help people in a country feed or deal with water problems or deal with various kinds of social problems. But there are some NGOs that have become funded by government entities and serve more the purpose of that government rather than trying to serve the people that they are ostensibly working for. One thing we saw in the 1980s, at that point the Central Intelligence Agency had been largely discredited because of scandals that had been exposed in the 1970s.
For 15 years, the CIA has secretly financed overseas activities of the National Students Association. But then there came to light a fantastic web of CIA penetrations.
So when the Reagan administration came in, there was this concept that instead of having the CIA, which traditionally would go into these different target countries, funding their media, funding NGOs, funding different political operations, that was essentially farmed out to a new organization called the National Endowment for Democracy, which was created in 1983. And it would do pretty much what the agency used to do. It would go into one of these countries and it would support various political groups, train activists, deal with journalists, business groups, and try to advance U.S. foreign policy interests, sometimes against the interests of the host government, the target government. And beyond that, they received financial and other logistical help from the National Endowment for Democracy and other U.S. agencies that helped them training activists, working with journalists to get their side presented more favorably. They work on things like, how do you get traction? How do you get things to go viral? How do you then use that to generate support for your cause?
And support was generated.
Mustafa Nayem.
Mustafa Nayem, a founder of one of Ukraine's new media outlets.
Доброго дня, доброї ночі, точніше.
Громадське TV. Knew very well how to make something go viral. It was his notorious Facebook post on November 21st, 2013, that brought the first crowds to Maidan. If you don't read the newspaper, you are uninformed. If you read the newspaper, you are misinformed. To deliver your message efficiently enough in the modern world with so many different technologies and means of communications, you must embrace them all. As the disturbing events of Euromaidan started on November 21, 2013, three new TV channels went on the air and suddenly became stunningly popular in Ukraine. Spilno TV, November 21st. Hromadske TV, November 22nd. And Espresso TV, November 24th, directly from opposition protest. These channels went viral, supporting the protests and encouraging more and more people to come to Maidan. November 30th of 2013 became the first turning point of Euromaidan and one of its most reported and mysterious events.
After riot police attacked peaceful protesters with clubs.
It happened in the early morning hours. The eyewitnesses that were there said that the police did use truncheons.
Coincidentally, Sergei Lovochkin is a close associate to many U.S. politicians. The Security Service of Ukraine had evidence that on that night, Lovochkin was in contact with opposition leader Yatsenyuk, where they discussed the clearing of Maidan on the pretext of installing the annual Christmas tree. News media reported that the riot police cruelly attacked the students peacefully sleeping in their tents, but scenes from the event seem to tell a different story. It appears that the protesters were waiting for the police. Additionally, there were dozens of journalists and cameramen from all the new public TV news outlets prepared to cover the events. And most ominously, a group of well-trained young men arrived to Maidan almost simultaneously with the riot police. They infiltrated the crowd and began provocations with insults, stones, and torches.
The riot sector in Ukraine represents a part of the Ukrainian population that has often favored fairly extreme right-wing positions. They had militias that came especially during the Maidan protests. There were groups that were being shipped into Kiev, where they would provide the muscle, in effect, for the demonstrations. So the demonstrations went from being relatively peaceful political protests to being increasingly violent.
The first step in any detective work is to establish a motive. It is now said that Sergei Lovochkin is held in high esteem by his powerful U.S. friends. Outraged by what was reported in the news, the Ukrainian people came out in force on the next day to vent their anger with the police actions. As veiled and masked as the color revolutions can be, an attentive viewer can see subtle patterns and similarities revealing their true nature. To make crowds act as one obedient group, they have to be united at the unconscious level. The masterminds of color revolutions know this well and have perfected the art. Symbolism is one of the most powerful tools to achieve this end. Revolutionary political organizations with surprisingly similar names and even more similar logos have appeared time and again, almost as omens marking the countries that would be hit by the colored plague next. They are often described as being aware and active, when they're actually trained and radical. They are the ones who take the first shot, literal and metaphorical, to transform the peaceful protests into full-blown coup d'etats. Their fingerprints can be found everywhere on the map of the color revolutions. Using all the experience of past generations, simple but effective tools like catchy sing-alongs and chanting are employed. Well known for exciting the crowd and creating a group identity, they depersonalize individuals and make them easier to manipulate. Incidentally, one such organization, Hromadske TV, received generous donations from the Dutch and U.S. embassies, as well as from the Renaissance Foundation, an NGO founded by George Soros.
I set up a foundation in Ukraine before Ukraine became independent of Russia. And the foundation has been functioning ever since. And it played an important part in events now.
I like criticism, but it must be my way.
We will be back here on this square to celebrate with you a Ukraine that stands with Europe and stands with the United States.
Well, members of Congress were visiting Ukraine during that period, most famously Congressman John McCain. So some of the people who were challenging their government, their elected government at that point, were being told by the senior U.S. official, a person who ran for president and a top official in the U.S. Congress, that the U.S. was with them.
I'm Senator John McCain, and it's always a pleasure to be back in Ukraine.
Senator McCain was, in a sense, giving the people in the Maidan a feeling that they had the backing of the most powerful country on earth.
This is about the future you want for your country. This is about the future you deserve.
In early February of 2014, as the Maidan crisis was getting more violent, there was a phone call that was intercepted. It was a call between the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, Victoria Nuland, and the U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt.
Questions of credibility are being raised after a private chat between two top U.S. diplomats was leaked online.
I think Yats is the guy who's got the economic experience, the governing experience. He's the guy, you know, what he needs is Klitsch and Tony Book on the outside. I just think Klitsch going in, he's going to be at that level working for Yatsenyuk. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Okay. Good. Well, do you want us to try to set up a call with him as the next step?
Sullivan's come back to me via VFR saying you need Biden, and I said probably tomorrow for an attaboy and to get the deets to stick. So
okay.
Biden's willing.
So you had this remarkable phone call where you have these two senior officials of the U.S. government apparently talking about a coup or how they were planning to restructure the government of Ukraine.
You.
No, exactly.
I'm not saying the whole U.S. government feels that way. There is division on this, but the neoconservative element wants very much to change the strategic dynamic in Eastern Europe. The neocons are very smart people, and they've been at this for a long time. They came in around the issue of propaganda. They studied how to create hot buttons for the American people. They had this experience when they were getting the American people to get excited about Central America back in the 1980s.
Sandinista regular army. The ground force is being equipped now with Russian artillery.
And they've been applying those same strategies ever since. They remain very dedicated to achieving their goals. They still want to get rid of certain governments. They wanted regime change in Syria, for instance, regime change in Iran. They're very skilled at this, and they have a lot of allies now inside the news media, inside the government, and that means that they can do a lot to control the narrative of any story.
I think in America these days, we have somehow told ourselves that there are a lot of ways of dealing with these problems other than hard power. Vladimir Putin cares about hard power.
The neoconservatives can now demonize a leader of a country. That sells with the American people. So you don't just sort of argue a policy. You attack the leader. So the neoconservatives became very skilled at picking out leaders, finding their ugly traits, and then highlighting them. Yanukovych, you might say, was a rather clunky political leader, but you make him into a devil. He's totally corrupt, and he's evil, and he wants to kill people in the Maidan, these wonderful white-hatted demonstrators. So you've got a black hat versus white hat. You keep repeating that basic scenario, and it works with the American people.
You've got to realize what Vladimir Putin is. He's an old KGB colonel that wants to restore the Russian Empire.
You make them into demons, and the American people find that the way they can understand the world. Once that happens, it's very difficult for a journalist or anyone else to say, you know, hold it, that guy, he's kind of more of a gray hat than a white hat or a black hat. And if you say that, you suddenly are you're a Yanukovych apologist or you're a Putin apologist, and then the attacks come on to the person saying it, the journalist, the academic, or whoever.
Any good director will tell you that tempo and rhythm are the most essential components to hold an audience's attention. It can also be called a method of betrayal when the allies and followers are relentlessly thrown into the revolutionary flame. The idea is simple. When the preparation work is done, the trigger just needs to be pulled to set the machine into full motion. The murder of politician Rafiq Hariri led to the Cedar Revolution. Looking back at the mysterious poisoning of Viktor Yushchenko right before the Orange Revolution of 2004, we see now that he became a sacred victim himself. Most political analysts believe the compassion of the Ukrainian people at that moment tilted the scales, giving him the presidency. The number of victims among the protesters during Euromaidan totaled over 100. They are called the Heavenly Hundred. All the sacred victims were immediately mythologized. The beating of students on November 30th, 2013 was the obvious trigger of Euromaidan. Those who sent trained provocateurs to the square very well realized that peaceful protesters were the ones who would get hurt the most. It's hard to keep protests going for months on end. Tensions subside, and people inevitably get tired. Holidays are also a big danger for revolutionary masterminds. People want to be home with their families and friends, and one needs to get inventive to keep people in a cold, tense city. On Christmas Day of 2013, tabloid journalist and political wannabe Tatiana Chornovol was chosen to become the tool to whip the protests on Maidan back up.
A civic activist and journalist known for investigating corruption among senior officials was beaten outside Ukraine's capital on Christmas.
Her heroic deeds as a reporter looked more like petty crimes, trespassing on the presidential residence of Viktor Yanukovych, leading a rioting crowd to seize the Kiev City Administration building, breaking into a car of the Security Service of Ukraine. It looked like Tatiana was more interested in making news than reporting it, and gaining name recognition that could be turned into votes for her struggling political career in the opposition party Fatherland. She gave the world media a Christmas present in 2013, when she was cruelly beaten by unknown assailants on the road. Despite the fact that in just 3 days all the suspects were arrested and confessed to beating Tatiana during a road rage incident, world media kept insisting upon the political background of the crime. Instantaneously, Tatiana became a heroic martyr, uniting people around her image.
The beating, coming amid political turmoil in Ukraine, this has drawn a protest.
Euromaidan was once again center stage, and Tatiana, in less than 2 months after the assault, she was already healthy enough to attack the office of Party of Regions, the party of Viktor Yanukovych. One of the staff members, 65-year-old IT specialist Vladimir Zaharov, was killed during the attack. So, where is Tatiana now? Well, she finally got her position of power in the new government. 1 month later, the time for another act in the play came. Armenian-Ukrainian protester Sergei Nigoyan was one of the first to arrive at Maidan. He wasn't radical or violent, but instead naive and full of hope. Watching Sergei read a patriotic poem is like watching a casting tape for the role of a sacred victim. Unfortunately, Sergei got the part. Betrayed by his brothers in arms, this video would eventually go viral after Sergei was killed early in the morning of January 22, 2014. The circumstances of his death remain unknown to this day. Even though the whole area of protests was heavily filmed at that time, there were no records or witnesses to help the investigation, and his body was moved immediately from the scene of the crime. Sergei became the first killed martyr of Euromaidan, and in a heartbeat, the police officers were appointed as his killers. Almost 2 years later, the official investigation would still deliver no results. Now, it is widely believed that Nigoyan's murder was staged by provocateurs to escalate the conflict. God speaks to people with the language of signs. On January 26, 2014, Pope Francis prayed for Ukraine, addressing thousands of people at St. Peter's Square in Vatican City.
Father, et Filius, et Spiritus Sanctus.
After the prayer, two white doves were released from the papal window and were immediately attacked by a crow and seagull. Those who understand the language could easily read the meaning of this omen. Soon, great forces, the seagull and the crow, would be tearing apart two Slavic nations, the white doves. This omen gave hope to the Ukrainian people, saying that by God's will, the doves would be saved. But it also predicted severe hardship and many victims. The events which could enter into the history of the color revolutions as the most massive human sacrifice yet arrived right on schedule, 1 month later.
For weeks, this European capital has been the scene of a violent uprising. Today, the bloodiest day yet.
The protesters are pushing up towards the government district, armed here with Molotov cocktails, but we saw handguns and shotguns too. There are casualties on both sides.
Well, she's just said that there are six dead people up there. Not just injured, dead. They say they've been hit by snipers.
And here again, we meet our old acquaintance from Narodny Rukh, Andriy Paruby, who is at the peak of his glory as self-proclaimed commandant of Maidan, which basically means the leader of the radical opposition.
The protesters were filmed leading a long line of riot police away. It's not clear where they were taking them. 67 officers are currently reported to be missing.
14 policemen dead and 43 wounded.
Earlier, from inside the protest camp, the opposition leader Vitali Klitschko urged his supporters to stay put. Each of you here should stay strong in spirit, he said, because we're not going anywhere.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The Limelight.
Americans have a gun-crazy culture, armed to the teeth, with some believing that they are the true patriots defending liberty against tyranny, says James Zogby, author, in an article published under the heading, The U.S. is Sick with Guns. Stay tuned for more. It's difficult to find words that adequately describe feelings on first learning of the massacre of 19 children and two teachers in Texas recently. There was shock, fear, even nausea, and then disgust at the realization that this nightmare Americans have experienced too many times before was playing out again. As expected, the next day's papers were filled with graphs and charts showing how many mass shootings Americans have had in the United States of America, an average of one a day. How many school massacres Americans have had in the past few decades? Dozens. How many gun homicides? 50 a day. And how many guns are owned by American civilians? More than 400 million. Bottom line, Americans own more guns and have a higher per capita murder rate and mass casualty events annually by far than any other country on planet Earth. No matter how many times Americans are told this and how many outrages they endure, Americans know in their hearts that nothing will be done, and so they are resigned to live with fear, knowing the nightmare will return in their lives. Let's face it, the U.S. is a sick country. Their debate on gun violence can best be described as deranged and pathetic. Republicans and Democrats, fearful of getting in the crosshairs of the gun lobby, refuse to take any action. They refuse to allow even limited controls on guns, arguing that the unfettered right to own weapons is sacred. The solution to gun violence, they argue, is more guns. Having seen legislation to ban assault weapons or place limits on gun purchases routinely defeated, Democrats have either given up trying or being reduced to offering weak proposals. The result? Each new tragedy gives birth to short-lived horror, a bit of finger-pointing, a half-hearted attempt to pass some limited reforms, and then failure. The reality is deeper than policies or legislation. It's not just that American guns are too sophisticated or that they have too many of them. The root problem is the U.S. sick gun culture. U.S. generations grew up playing cowboys and Indians or cops and robbers. If they didn't have cap pistols or toy rifles, they simply improvised with a pointed finger, a thumb trigger, and po-po, you're dead. American generations do not play these games. Instead, they act out more fanciful tales of fantasy futuristic heroes, all possessing more potent weapons. But they will also make do, when needed, with sticks or fingers, morphing them into weapons possessed of all sorts of destructive powers. And the video games they play and movies they watch are largely based on killing, killing and killing, so much so that it has become normalized. From cradle to grave, Americans are fed a steady diet of guns and violence. From cartoons, westerners or cop shows to video games and Quentin Tarantino's Bullet and Blood Feast, guns and shooting and killing are ingrained into their deep culture. Like mom and apple pie, guns have become part of who Americans are as a nation. There is a scene in the film Noir called Classic Gone Crazy where Bart, the film's main character as a young boy, is starting into a store window. The object of his desire is a six-shooter. Unable to resist its call, he shatters the glass and attempts to steal the weapon, only to be arrested in the act. The next scene has Bart standing before a judge trying to explain his obsession with guns. He tells the court, "I feel good when I'm shooting them. I feel awful, good inside, like I'm somebody." Gun Crazy Bart's fixation with the weapon is pathological and it leads ultimately to his demise. When we see the look on the faces of gun enthusiasts lining up to make what they fear may be their last purchase before Democrats take their guns away, we think of Bart. When we watch them sensually cradling their assault weapons or zoomed out at the shooting range, we think of Bart, knowing that nothing good can come of it. We know all this, and yet there continues to be a pathological obsession not only with owning weapons, but also with blocking any reasonable controls on their ownership. The modus operandi of this lobby is simple and direct. They allow no discussion, no compromise, no concessions, and no wavering or weakness. And they mask their deadly advocacy with the Constitution, arguing that what is at stake is the very survival of Americans' freedom. In the process, they further inflame the passions of their adherents. In the end, the U.S. has a gun-crazy culture, armed to the teeth with some believing that they are the true patriots defending liberty against tyranny. When we add to this mix all of the resentments and pressures that gave birth to the Tea Party and Trumpism, including a not-so-subtle appeal to race, Americans are left with a dangerous and volatile brew. They will have more angry debates. They may pass some weak and ineffective legislation, and then they will move on to another issue that will distract Americans until the next massacre occurs. And another one will occur, because until they have a prolonged and serious national discussion about their sick love affair with guns and purge themselves of this pathology, they will only be skirting around the edges of an issue that is killing American civilians.
Yani
Bazaar
Gas powers production, and oil greases the gears of the industry. Without gas and oil, most industries probably wouldn't thrive as they are today. The world consumes around 36 billion barrels of oil per year. Oil and gas are major industries in the energy market and play a significant role in the global economy as the world's primary fuel source. Meanwhile, the process and systems involved in producing and distributing oil and gas are highly complex. They require lots of money and state-of-the-art technology.
Hello there. Welcome to another edition of Bazaar. Today, we'll venture through Iran's oil and gas industry. This sector is massive, and its enormity doesn't quite sink in until you visit one of the industry's annual exhibits. So, we visited the country's 26th International Oil, Gas, Refining and Petrochemical Exhibition, dubbed the Iran Oil and Gas Show. We'll explore this sector's development and uncover why it's essential to the national economy. What are we waiting for? Let's get to it.
The Oil and Gas Show is one of the largest exhibitions in the global oil industry. It takes place every year and serves as a place for domestic and foreign industry participants to interact. The exhibition is based on the theme of knowledge-based oil, Iranian production, and global exports. It is based on this year's economic goal set by Iran's leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The leader has emphasized strengthening the knowledge-based economy by adopting a scientific and technical approach in all fields. The exhibition showcases the latest products made by Iranian knowledge-based firms.
It's a platform for expanding business markets and finding potential customers and suppliers, among other things. We caught up with a few participants to see what types of products and services they offered in this sector. This company manages an entire oil field in southern Iran. Moreover, it engineers machines and compressors needed for refining and processing crude oil and gas products.
Petro Iran Development Company, Petco, is one of the subsidiaries of NIOC, and we are acting as an E&P and GC contractor, and we are involved in several upstream and downstream projects, mainly in Iran and even abroad. The 26th oil and gas show was one of the biggest show during the past even 10 years. As I noticed during these 3 days, there were very good participation of foreign companies. And these foreign companies, it was my surprise that they are not seeking for individual work by themselves. They are looking for cooperative, joint ventures with Iranian companies. And because we have a very good, capable Iranian manufacturers and contractors, and I have seen lots of agreements that have been signed during these 3 days. There are very big opportunities for investment in Iran because of nowadays situation in the world. There are a very massive request, demand for Iranian oil and Iranian industry, manufacturers and contractors. And as it was noticed in this fair, more than 8 billion euros of investment agreement was signed. And I think that it, we have this opportunity to up to 20 billion euros of investment to sign with the Iranian and even foreign countries.
Another pavilion displayed the cutting-edge technology used in downstream and upstream oil industries. This company is also developing various oil fields and supplying electrical power.
Each year, scores of people and industry participants visit and hold pavilions in this exhibit. Such events also provide unique access to leading decision makers in the oil and gas industry. Additionally, it is a place for knowledge exchange and determining current needs and future development vectors. This year, the fair opened with 1,200 Iranian and 44 foreign exhibitors from 11 countries.
Another benefit of the fair is networking and creating new business opportunities throughout the energy sector with prospective business agreements. A significant number of business deals were closed during the 3-day oil and gas show. There is a lot of potential for investment in the oil and gas industry. This exhibit provides chances to link investors with potential joint ventures in this field. It's noteworthy that 23 universities and research centers and over 100 knowledge-based companies, startups, and technology parks participated in this event. High-profile representatives of foreign companies from 22 countries were present at the show too. The most notable was the Secretary General of the Gas Exporting Countries Forum, Mohammad Hamal. Other important figures included the Minister of Oil, Javad Oji, Parliament Speaker, Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf, and the Head of Parliament's Energy Committee, Feridun Hasanvand. The sprawling fairgrounds were packed with all sorts of equipment and machinery used in the oil and gas industry. These ranged from advanced technology for extraction, processing, storage, transport, safety systems, and control technology. We spoke with a representative of a company specializing in producing composite pipes, which are high in demand in this sector.
Iran's oil and gas industry is thriving and has taken giant strides in production. It owes its many successes largely to knowledge-based companies and research institutions that have offered their services in developing this sector. Expanding the gas and oil industry has been at the top of the government's agenda for years. Over time, it has implemented several measures to this end.
The government is focusing on knowledge-based firms and research companies as the bedrock of developing the oil and gas sector.
The oil ministry has outlined several goals to tap into the high capacities of knowledge-based firms to boost production in the oil and gas sector. These goals are optimizing production, overhauling production facilities, and value chain developments. This goes hand in hand with the domestic development of innovative technologies. So, the government is supporting knowledge-based firms and startups and their efforts to manufacture commodities and equipment required in the oil and gas industry.
Finding investors, whether domestic or international, is a top priority for the government. Iran is rich with oil and gas reserves and is the fourth largest oil producer among OPEC members. Plus, Iran possesses the third largest oil reserves in the world. So it's not surprising that the government would want to find ways to exploit its potential.
The oil ministry has inked 50 agreements and memoranda of understanding worth nearly $17 billion in the first 9 months of last year alone. These deals were with petrochemical holdings, banks, and negotiating with reputable international companies. The agreements mainly focus on developing joint oil and gas fields, flare gas collections, and developing value chains. It plans on using knowledge-based companies and domestic manufacturing potentials to this end. The Minister of Oil, Javad Oji, says exhibits like the Oil and Gas Show reflect Iran's capability and authority despite sanctions. Oji also explains that Iran's gas and oil sector is steadily inching forward and is proving the failure of the US sanction policies. The official highlighted that the Oil and Gas Show displays the country's resiliency and its ability to diversify its economy through energy diplomacy. The minister expressed optimism for the future of this industry as there are grounds for returning to the energy trade. Oji says this can happen through gas swap deals, finding new markets for oil and its byproducts, and exporting technical engineering services. All things considered, there is a bright future for Iran's oil market and industry. Plus, it offers numerous lucrative investment opportunities in downstream and upstream sectors. The need for home appliances dates back to the early stages of human existence, when cave dwellers began developing tools to preserve and prepare food. Today, home technology has become more sophisticated to match our fast-paced lifestyles. The level of convenience and comfort of home is also determined by these items, and they have even become a status symbol for some. In a sense, home appliances define modern living, changing the means of dealing with food, clothing, cleaning, and so much more.
This week, we're going to dive into the world of home appliance production. We want to see who the major players are in this industry and see how the market is doing. We will also uncover some of the major contributions of the home appliance industry to the country's economy as a whole.
Our journey this time took us to Abbasabad Industrial City on the outskirts of the capital Tehran. There, we visited a company that specializes in the production of home appliances. Emerson was established some 40 years ago and has become a household name in this industry. In the early days of its activity, it started out by making freezers. Over the years, it has expanded its product list and now manufactures refrigerators, cookers, and washing machines, among a long list of other items. This company has expansive production halls, which house its chain production machinery. Each production hall is tasked with a certain process of manufacturing, such as preparing material for assembling. From start to finish, everything happens at the production lines. Having an assembly line in the manufacturing process helps keep production processes regimented. This ensures the uniform production of items.
It might be interesting to know that this company uses the latest computer-assisted robotic equipment in its production halls to get the job done. Automating processes help guarantee that each step is performed with uniform standards throughout. The other advantage is it allows quality control checks and implementation of standards to be performed with speed and accuracy. An integral part of this company is its research and development department. It is strategically intertwined with the production space. Products here are randomly pulled and tested at different stages. But that's not all. This advanced department also collaborates with foreign companies in research. Its production lines produce hundreds of home appliances each day. With this in mind, it has also provided hundreds of job opportunities. The company employs expert technical engineers and experienced workers to manage designs and machines. This company has a unique outlook toward the future and is continuously looking for more ways to foster growth opportunities. As part of its future vision, it hopes to expand its reach and gain a larger share in the international market by increasing its product portfolio. Like many in the manufacturing business, the US sanctions have caused some challenges for this company, but this firm was able to turn these challenges into major opportunities for growth.
As you might know, local home appliance brands in this sector also compete with foreign ones. Iranian manufacturers produce the same quality of home appliances as their international competitors, yet many in the country still seem to be drawn to foreign names. It might be interesting to do a little price comparison here.
Iran's culture and traditions play a big role in consumer trends. For example, newlyweds are expected to move into a home fully furnished with brand new items. The budget needed to furnish a home can cost upwards of $30,000 depending on the decision to purchase foreign brands. However, the budget needed to purchase Iranian brands for ordinary items is far less. One would need a budget of around $10,000 to get it done. For example, the cost of an average two-door Iranian brand refrigerator is roughly $350. The same standard double-door refrigerator made by a Korean brand is roughly $2,500 when purchased in Iran. That is, of course, based on the daily exchange rate of 30,000 tumans to the dollar. In 2018, the government banned the import of foreign brands. Nevertheless, these brands were still seen in the domestic market. This was partly due to existing stockpiles of previous imports. The government implemented the initiative aiming at strengthening domestic production and sales. But this gave rise to a lucrative black market of smuggled home appliances, which is still being regulated. Trafficked goods have been reduced in recent years. However, they still find their way into the domestic market.
Companies like the one we just mentioned are at the helm of this industry. Currently, there are some 80,000 home appliance manufacturing units in the country. Their domestic productions have not only helped satisfy local needs, but also saved the country millions on imports. Officials say the country is now self-sufficient in terms of the production of these items.
Iran's home appliance manufacturers were operating below their potential capacities around 2018. Before the ban on imports, some 85% of foreign brands available in the country were domestically produced under foreign licenses. The necessary infrastructure existed, but there was little domestic demand due to the competition with foreign brands. Based on figures from the Electrical, Metal and Home Appliance Office of the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, the 2018 import ban was effective. Data from the office shows last year Iran produced over 15 million home appliance units.
This is 3 million units more than the government's target of last year and double the production figure of 2018. Officials with the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade say indigenizing home appliance parts has reduced imports by $500 million. Such an increase in production also means that home appliance exports skyrocketed. Last year, $140 million worth of these items were exported, and the government hopes to push this figure to $200 million this year. Some industry participants argue one way to increase quality and expand Iran's home appliance market is by lifting the ban on imports. They say the industry has grown by leaps and bounds in recent years, adding it is capable of growing.